This is Audible.
Listening Library presents A Single Shard by Linda Sue Park. Read for you by Graham Malcolm. A small village on the west coast of Korea, mid to late 12th century. Chapter 1.
"Hey, Tree Ear, have you hungered well today?" Crane Man called out as Tree Ear drew near the bridge.
The well-fed of the village greeted each other politely by saying, "Have you eaten well today?" Tree Ear and his friend turned the greeting inside out for their own little joke. Tree Ear squeezed the bulging pouch that he wore at his waist. He had meant to hold back the good news, but the excitement spilled out of him.
"Crane Man, a good thing that you greeted me so just now, for later today we will have to use the proper words."
He held the bag high. Tree Ear was delighted when Crane Man's eyes widened in surprise. He knew that Crane Man would guess at once. Only one thing could give a bag that kind of smooth fullness. Not carrot tops or chicken bones which protruded in odd lumps, no. The bag was filled with rice. Crane Man raised his walking crutch in a salute.
"Come, my young friend, tell me how you came by such a fortune. A tale worth hearing, no doubt."
Tree Ear had been trotting along the road on his early morning perusal of the village rubbish heaps. Ahead of him, a man carried a heavy load on a jige, an open-framed backpack made of branches. On the jige was a large woven straw container, the kind commonly used to carry rice. Tree Ear knew that the rice must be from last year's crop. In the fields surrounding the village, this season's rice had only just begun to grow. It would be many months before the rice was harvested and the poor allowed to glean the fallen grain from the bare fields. Only then would they taste the pure flavor of rice and feel its solid goodness in their bellies. Just looking at the straw box made water rush into Tree Ear's mouth. The man had paused in the road and hoisted the wooden jige higher on his back, shifting the cumbersome weight. As Tree Ear stared, rice began to trickle out of a hole in the straw box. The trickle thickened and became a stream. Oblivious, the man continued on his way. For a few short moments, Tree Ear's thoughts wrestled with one another.
"Tell him, quickly, before he loses too much rice." "No, don't say anything. You will be able to pick up the fallen rice after he rounds the bend."
Tree Ear made his decision. He waited until the man had reached the bend in the road, then ran to catch him.
"Honorable sir," Tree Ear said, panting and bowing, "as I walked behind you, I noticed that you are marking your path with rice."
The farmer turned and saw the trail of rice. A well-built man, with a broad, suntanned face, he pushed his straw hat back, scratched his head, and laughed ruefully.
"Impatience," said the farmer. "I should have had this container woven with a double wall, but it would have taken more time. Now I pay for not waiting a bit longer."
He struggled out of the jige's straps and inspected the container. He prodded the straw to close the gap, but to no avail, so he threw his arms up in mock despair. Tree Ear grinned. He liked the farmer's easygoing nature.
"Fetch me a few leaves, boy," said the farmer.
Tree Ear complied, and the man stuffed them into the container as a temporary patch. The farmer squatted to don the jige. As he started walking, he called over his shoulder,
"Good deserves good, urchin. The rice on the ground is yours, if you can be troubled to gather it." "Many thanks, kind sir,"
Tree Ear bowed, very pleased with himself. He had made a lucky guess, and his waist pouch would soon be filled with rice. Tree Ear had learned from Crane Man's example. Foraging in the woods and rubbish heaps, gathering fallen grain heads in the autumn, these were honorable ways to garner a meal, requiring time and work. But stealing and begging, Crane Man said, made a man no better than a dog.
"Work gives a man dignity. Stealing takes it away," he often said.
Following Crane Man's advice was not always easy for Tree Ear. Today, for example,
Was it stealing, to wait, as Trehear had, for more rice to fall before alerting the man that his rice bag was leaking? Did a good deed balance a bad one? Trehear often pondered these kinds of questions, alone or in discussion with Craneman.
Such questions serve in two ways, Craneman had explained. They keep a man's mind sharp, and his thoughts off his empty stomach.
Now, as always, he seemed to know Trehear's thoughts without hearing them spoken.
"Tell me about this farmer," he said. "What kind of man was he?"
Trehear considered the question for several moments, stirring his memory. At last he answered,
"One who lacks patience. He said it himself. He had not wanted to wait for a sturdier container to be built, and he could not be bothered to pick up the fallen rice."
Trehear paused.
"But he laughed easily, even at himself. If he were here now, and heard you tell of waiting a little longer before speaking, what do you think he would say or do?"
"He would laugh," Trehear said, surprising himself with the speed of his response. Then, more slowly,
"I think he would not have minded."
Craneman nodded, satisfied. And Trehear thought of something his friend often said. "Scholars read the great words of the world, but you and I must learn to read the world itself." Trehear was so called after the mushroom that grew in wrinkled half-circles on dead or fallen tree trunks, emerging from the rotten wood without benefit of parent seed. A good name for an orphan, Craneman said. If ever Trehear had had another name, he no longer remembered it, nor the family that might have named him so. Trehear shared the space under the bridge with Craneman, or, rather, Craneman shared it with him. After all, Craneman had been there first, and would not be leaving any time soon. The shriveled and twisted calf and foot he had been born with made sure of that. Trehear knew the story of his friend's name.
"When they saw my leg at birth, it was thought I would not survive," Craneman had said. "Then, as I went through life on one leg, it was said that I was like a crane. But besides standing on one leg, cranes are also a symbol of long life."
"True enough," Craneman added. He had outlived all his family, and unable to work, had been forced to sell his possessions one by one, including, at last, the roof over his head. Thus it was that he had come to live under the bridge. Once, a year or so earlier, Trehear had asked him how long he had lived there. Craneman shook his head. He no longer remembered. But then he brightened and hobbled over to one side of the bridge, beckoning Trehear to join him.
"I do not remember how long I have been here," he said, "but I know how long you have."
And he pointed upward to the underside of the bridge.
"I wonder that I have not shown you this before."
On one of the slats was a series of deep scratches as if made with a pointed stone. Trehear examined them, then shook his head at Craneman.
"So?" "One mark for each spring since you came here," Craneman explained. "I kept count of your years, for I thought the time would come when you would like to know how old you are."
Trehear looked again, this time with keen interest. There was a mark for each finger of both hands, 10 marks in all. Craneman answered before Trehear asked.
"No, you have more than 10 years, he said. "When you first came and I began making those marks, you were, in perhaps your second year, already on 2 legs and able to talk."
Trehear nodded. He knew the rest of the story already. Craneman had learned but little from the man who had brought Trehear to the bridge. The man had been paid by a kindly monk in the city of Songdo to bring Trehear to the little seaside village of Chulpo. Trehear's parents had died of fever, and the monk knew of an uncle in Chulpo. When the travellers arrived, the man discovered that the uncle no longer lived there, the house having been abandoned long before. He took Trehear to the temple on the mountainside, but the monks had been unable to take the boy in because fever raged there as well. The villagers told the man to take the child to the bridge, where Craneman would care for him until the temple was free of sickness.
"And," Craneman always said, "when a monk came to fetch you a few months later, you would not leave. You clung to my good leg like a monkey to a tree, not crying, but not letting go either. The monk went away. You stayed."
When Trehear was younger, he had asked for the story often, as if hearing it over and over again might reveal something more, what his father's trade had been, what his mother had looked like, where his uncle had gone. But there was never anything more. It no longer mattered.
If there was more to having a home than Crane Man and the bridge, Tree Ear had neither knowledge nor need of it. Breakfast that morning was a feast. A bit of the rice boiled to a gruel in a cast-off earthenware pot, served up in a bowl carved from a gourd. And Crane Man produced yet another surprise to add to the meal. 2 chicken leg bones. No flesh remained on the arid bones, but the 2 friends cracked them open and worried away every scrap of marrow from inside. Afterward, Tria washed in the river and fetched a gourd of water for Crane Man, who never went into the river if he could help it. He hated getting his feet wet. Then Tria set about tidying up the area under the bridge. He took care to keep the place neat, for he disliked having to clear a space to sleep at the tired end of the day. Housekeeping complete, Tree-Ear left his companion and set off back up the road. This time, he did not zigzag between rubbish heaps, but strode purposefully toward a small house set apart from the others at a curve in the road. Tree-Ear slowed as he neared the mud and wood structure. He tilted his head, listening, and grinned when the droning syllables of a song chant reached his ears. The master potter, Min, was singing, which meant that it was a throwing day. Min's house backed onto the beginnings of the foothills and their brushy growth, which gave way to pine-wooded mountains beyond. Tree-Ear swung wide of the house. Under the deep eaves at the back, Min kept his potter's wheel. He was there now, his grey head bent over the wheel, chanting his wordless song. Tree-Ear made his way cautiously to his favourite spot, behind a polonia tree, whose low branches kept him hidden from view. He peeped through the leaves and caught his breath in delight. Min was just beginning a new pot. Min threw a mass of clay the size of a cabbage onto the centre of the wheel. He picked it up and threw it again, threw it several times. After one last throw, he sat down and stared at the clay for a moment. Using his foot to spin the base of the wheel, he placed dampened hands on the sluggardly lump, and for the 100th time, Tree-Ear watched the miracle. In only a few moments, the clay rose and fell, grew taller, then rounded down until it curved into perfect symmetry. The spinning slowed. The chant, too, died out and became a mutter of words that Tree-Ear could not hear. Min sat up straight. He crossed his arms and leaned back a little, as if to see the vase from a distance. Turning the wheel slowly with his knee, he inspected the graceful shape for invisible faults. Then, bah! He shook his head and, in a single motion of disgust, scooped up the clay and slapped it back onto the wheel, whereupon it collapsed into an oafish lump again, as if ashamed. Tree-Ear opened his mouth to let out his breath silently, only then realizing that he had been keeping it back. To his eyes, the vase had been perfect, its width half its height, its curves like those of a flower petal. Why, he wondered, and Min found it unworthy. What had he seen that so displeased him? Min never failed to reject his first attempt. Then he would repeat the whole process. This day, Tree-Ear was able to watch the clay rise and fall 4 times before Min was satisfied. Each of the 4 efforts had looked identical to Tree-Ear, but something about the 4th pleased Min. He took a length of twine and slipped it deftly under the vase to release it from the wheel, then placed the vase carefully on a tray to dry. As Tree-Ear crept away, he counted the days on his fingers. He knew the potter's routine well. It would be many days before another throwing day. The village of Chulpo faced the sea, its back to the mountains and the river edging it like a neat seam. Its potters produced the delicate celadon ware that had achieved fame not only in Korea, but as far away as the court of the Chinese emperor. Chulpo had become an important village for ceramics by virtue of both its location and its soil. On the shore of the Western Sea, it had access both to the easiest sea route northward and to plentiful trade with China. And the clay from the village pits contained exactly the right amount of iron to produce the exquisite grey-green colour of celadon, so prized by collectors. Tree-Ear knew every potter in the village, but until recently he had known them only for their rubbish heaps. It was hard for him to believe that he had never taken the time to watch them at work before. In recent years, the pottery from the village kilns had gained great favour among those wealthy enough to buy pieces as gifts for both the royal court and the Buddhist temples, and the potters had achieved new levels of prosperity. The pickings from their rubbish heaps had become richer in consequence, and for the first time, Tree-Ear was able to forget about his stomach for a few hours each day. During those hours, it was Min he chose to watch most closely. The other potters kept their wheels in small windowless shacks. But in the warm months, Min preferred to work beneath the eaves behind his house, open to the breeze and the view of the mountains. Working without walls meant that Min possessed great skill and the confidence to match it. Potters guarded their secrets jealously. A new shape for a teapot, a new inscribed design, these were things that the potters refused to reveal until a piece was ready to show to a buyer. Min did not seem to care about such secrecy. It was as if he were saying, "Go ahead, watch me, no matter, you will not be able to imitate my skill." It was true, and it was also the main reason that Tri-ear loved watching Min. His work was the finest in the region, perhaps even in the whole country. Chapter 2 Tri-ear peered between the leaves of the Polonia tree, puzzled. Several days had passed since his last visit to Min's house, and he had calculated that it was time for another throwing day. But there was no sign of Min at his work, nor any wet clay on the wheel. The workshop area was tidy, with a few chickens in the yard, the only signs of life. Emboldened by the silence, Tri-ear emerged from his hiding place and approached the house. Against the wall was a set of shelves holding a few of Min's latest creations. They were at the stage the potters called leather-hard, dried by the air but not yet glazed or fired. Unglazed, the work was of little interest to thieves. The finished pieces were surely locked up somewhere in the house. Tri-ear paused at the edge of the brush and listened hard one last time. A hen clucked proudly, and Tri-ear grinned. Min would have an egg for his supper. But there was still no sign of the potter, so Tri-ear tiptoed the last few steps to stand before the shelves. For the first time, he was seeing Min's work at close range. There was a duck that would have fit in the palm of his hand, with a tiny hole in its bill. Tri-ear had seen such a duck in use before. A painter had been sitting on the riverbank working on a water scene. The painter had poured water from the duck's bill onto a stone, a single drop at a time, mixing ink to exactly the correct consistency for his work. Tri-ear stared at Min's duck. Though it was now a dull grey, so detailed were its features that he found himself half listening for the sound of a quack. Min had shaped and then carved the clay to form curve of wing and tilt of head. Even the little tail curled up with an impudence that made Tri-ear smile. He tore his gaze away from the duck to examine the next piece, a tall jug with ribbed lines that imitated the shape of a melon. The lines were perfectly symmetrical, curving so gracefully from top to bottom that Tri-ear longed to run his finger along the smooth, shallow grooves. The melon's stem and leaves were cleverly shaped to form the lid of the jug. The last piece on the shelf was the least interesting, a rectangular lidded box as large as his two hands. It was completely undecorated. Disappointed in its plainness, Tri-ear was ready to turn away when a thought struck him. Outside, the box was plain, but perhaps inside. Holding his breath, he reached out, gently lifted the lid, and looked inside. He grinned in double delight at his own correct guess and at Min's skill. The plain box held five smaller boxes, a small round one in the centre and four curved boxes that fit around it perfectly. The small boxes appeared to completely fill the larger container, but Min had left exactly the right amount of space to allow any of them to be lifted out. Tri-ear put the lid of the large box down on the shelf and picked up one of the curved containers. On the underside of its lid was a lip of clay that held the lid in place. Tri-ear's eyes flickered back and forth between the small pieces in his hand and the larger container, his brow furrowed in thought. How did Min fit them together so perfectly? Perhaps he made the large box, then a second one to fit inside, and cut the smaller boxes from that. Or did he make an inside box first and fit the larger box around it? Maybe he began with the small central box, then the curved ones, then... Someone shouted. The chicken squawked noisily, and Tri-ear dropped what he was holding. He stood there, paralyzed for a moment, then threw his hands up in front of his face to protect himself from the blows that were raining down on his head and shoulders. It was the old potter. "Thief!" he screamed. "How dare you come here? How dare you touch my work?" Tri-ear did the only thing he could think of. He dropped to his knees and cowered in a deep, formal bow.
"Please, please, honorable sir,
I was not stealing your work. I came only to admire it.
Min's cane halted in mid-blow. The potter stood over the boy with the cane still poised for another strike.
Have you been here before, beggar boy?
Tre'ir's thoughts scrambled about as he tried to think what to answer. The truth seemed easiest.
Yes, honourable sir. I often come to watch you work.
Ah.
Tre'ir was still doubled over in his bow, but out of the corner of his eye he could see the tip of the cane as it was lowered to the ground. He allowed himself a single sigh of relief.
So, is it you who breaks the twigs and bruises the leaves of the Polonia tree just beyond?
Tre'ir nodded, feeling his face flush. He had thought he was covering his tracks well.
Not to steal, you say? How do I know you do not watch just to see when I have made something of extra value?
Now Tre'ir raised his head and looked at Min. He kept his voice respectful, but his words were proud.
I would not steal. Stealing and begging make a man no better than a dog.
The potter stared at the boy for a long moment. At last, Min seemed to make up his mind about something, and when he spoke again, his voice had lost the sharpest edge of its anger.
So you are not stealing. It is the same thing to me. With one part damaged, the rest is of no use.
He gestured at the misshapen pottery box on the ground, badly dented from its fall.
Get on your way, then. I know better than to ask for payment for what you have ruined.
Tre'ir stood slowly, shame hot in his breast. It was true. He could never hope to pay Min for the damaged box. Min picked it up and tossed it on the rubbish heap at the side of the yard. He continued to mutter crossly,
"Aye, 3 days' work, and for what? For nothing. I'm behind now. The order will be late."
Tre'ir had taken a few dragging steps out of the yard, but on hearing the old potter's mutterings, he lifted his head and turned back toward him.
"Honourable Potter, sir, could I not work for you, as payment? Perhaps my help could save you some time."
Min shook his head impatiently.
"What could you do, an untrained child? I have no time to teach you. You would be more trouble than help."
Tre'ir stepped forward eagerly.
"You would not need to teach so much as you think, sir. I have been watching you for many months now. I know how you mix the clay and turn the wheel. I have watched you make many things."
The potter waved one hand to cut off the boy's words and spoke with derision.
"Turn the wheel, ha! He thinks he can sit and make a pot, just like that."
Tre'ir crossed his arms stubbornly and did not look away. Min picked up the rest of the box set and tossed it too on the rubbish heap. He muttered under his breath, so Tre'ir could not hear the words. Min straightened up and glanced around, first at his shelf, then at the wheel, and finally at Tre'ir.
"Yes. All right," he said, his voice still rough with annoyance. "Come tomorrow. At daybreak, then. 3 days it took me to make that box, so you will give me 9 days' work in return. I cannot even begin to think how much greater the value of my work is than yours, but we will settle on this for a start."
Tre'ir bowed in agreement. He walked around the side of the house, then flew off down the road. He could hardly wait to tell Crane Man. For the first time in his life, he would have real work to do. Upon arriving the next day for work, Tre'ir learned that it was Min's turn to chop wood for the kiln fires. That was why he had not been at home the day before. Like most of the potter's villages, Chulpo had a communal kiln. Set on the hillside just outside the centre of the village, it looked like a long, low tunnel made of hardened clay. The potters took turns using the kiln and keeping up the supply of fuel. Min handed Tre'ir a small axe and led him around the side of the house to a wheeled cart.
"Fill the cart with wood," Min barked. "Dry wood, not wet. Do not come back until the cart is full."
Tre'ir felt as though the sun had suddenly dimmed. The night before, sleep had not come easily. He had imagined himself at the wheel, a beautiful pot growing from the clay before him. Perhaps, he thought now, if he chopped enough wood quickly, there would still be time at the end of the day. Min quashed that hope with his next words.
"Take care to go well into the mountains," he said. "Far too many trees have been cut too close to the village. You will walk a long way before you find a plentiful stand of trees."
Tre'ir swallowed a sigh as he placed the axe in the cart. Grasping the two handles, he wheeled the cart onto the road. He turned to wave farewell, but the potter was no longer there. The sound of the throwing song floated out from behind the house. Chopping wood for hours without a single bite to eat had been hard enough, but the worst of that day was the long trip back down the mountainside with the cart full of wood. The path was rutted and bumpy. The homemade cart was poorly balanced, awkward with its heavy load. At every step, Tre'ir had to keep his eyes trained on the path and the cart. In spite of his efforts, whenever the wheels hit a deep rut, the cart tipped precariously and some of the logs spilled out. Then he had to stop to pick up the fallen wood. It was more than annoying, because he had been careful to lay the wood neatly as he chopped, and each bump led to further disarray of the tidy pile. After this had happened more times than he could count, Tre'ir neared the end of the mountain path. Soon it would widen and smooth out into the more heavily travelled foothills road. Tre'ir lifted his head for a moment in eager anticipation of the end of his journey. Just then, the right-hand wheel caught a stone. The cart handles were wrenched from his hands, and the cart tipped onto its side. The momentum pulled Tre'ir off balance, and he tripped over the cart and tumbled head-first to the ground. He sat up, dazed. For a moment, he didn't know whether to curse or cry. He set his lips together tightly and scrambled to his feet, then pulled the cart upright and began flinging the wood back into it in a frenzy. As he heaved, a large, rough log, an arrow of pain shot through his right hand. He cried out and clenched it into a fist for a moment until the throbbing eased a little. Then he opened it cautiously and examined the injury. The pillow of fluid that had formed on his palm during the long hours of wielding the axe had burst. Blood ran from the wound, mixing with dirt and small bits of bark. Tre'ir stared at it, and he could not stop the tears that pressed hot behind his eyes. Angrily, he blinked away the tears and set about tearing a strip of cloth from the bottom of his tunic. There was no water nearby, so he spat on his palm and wiped it as best he could, clenching his teeth against the pain. He used his other hand and his teeth to wrap and tie the cloth into a makeshift bandage. From then on, he worked slowly and methodically, stacking the wood in neat rows in the cart. The sun was low in the sky when he finished at last and wheeled the cart cautiously down the path to the foothills road. Tre'ir dragged himself home to the bridge that evening. Craneman's normally placid expression was replaced with a frown of worry when Tre'ir stumbled into the space under the struts and collapsed in a heap on the ground. Craneman said nothing. He merely held out a bowl in which he had placed a small mound of rice and a little pile of boiled greens. Too exhausted to eat, Tre'ir waved the food away. But Craneman hobbled to his side and used his crutch for support as he eased himself down to sit next to Tre'ir. Craneman picked up a little rice in his fingers and, insistently, but still without a word, began feeding Tre'ir as if he were a baby. Tre'ir did not remember finishing the meal, but he awoke the next morning to see Craneman swing himself down under the bridge by holding one of the struts, as he always did. Small and slight, and who knew how old, Craneman still moved his upper body with the ease of a young man. Many were the times that Tre'ir forgot completely about the useless leg. Where had Craneman been so early? Tre'ir sat up stiffly and began to rub his eyes. As he brought his right hand up to his face, he caught sight of the crude bandage. It was stiff with dried blood. "Yes, that is what I have been about," said Craneman. "Now, let us see what we can see." Tre'ir held out his hand. Craneman untied the bandage and began to unwrap it. "Sst!" Tre'ir hissed sharply in pain and snatched his hand away. The final layer of cloth clung stubbornly to the wound, and Craneman had been trying to pull it off. "Come now, my monkey friend," said Craneman, kindly but firmly. "It must be removed so we can clean the wound. The demons of sickness are no doubt already scheming to enter your body through such a door." Tre'ir rose and shuffled to the water's edge. He crouched and dipped his hand in the water. Its coolness soothed the throb, and its wetness loosened the cloth's grip on the wound. Wincing, he eased the bandage away. While Tre'ir cleaned his wound, Craneman took the strip of cloth and washed it thoroughly with water from the gourd bowl, scrubbing it against a flat stone at the river's edge. Then he wrung it out and handed it to Tre'ir, who scrambled up the bank and hung it on a strut to dry in the sun. From his waist pouch, Craneman took a handful of green herbs he had gathered in the woods earlier that morning. He ground them to a paste between two stones, then scooped up some of the paste with two fingers and applied it to Tre'ir's hand. "Close your hand," Craneman ordered. "Squeeze, so the healing juices may enter the wound." The two friends ate the last of the rice treasure for breakfast, Tre'ir holding the paste as he ate with his other hand. Then Craneman tied the now dry strip of cloth back into a bandage. "There," he said. "A few days' rest will see that hand good as new." He looked at Tre'ir sternly. Tree-Ear said nothing. He knew that Crane Man had already guessed there would be no rest that day. There was still 8 days' work to be done for Min. Chapter 3 Tree-Ear trotted up the road toward Min's house, but he slowed a little when he heard the potter scolding him even before he arrived. What kind of useless boy was he, coming back so late the day before and leaving the cart without a word? That wood should have been taken to the kiln and unloaded. Min had done it himself at dusk, and had nearly injured himself stumbling home in the darkness. Such help was worse than no help at all. Now, did Tree-Ear really intend to make himself useful? If not, it would be better for him to forget their whole arrangement. Finally, Min paused to draw breath. Tree-Ear dared not look up. He felt like a beast with two heads, one ashamed, the other resentful. Ashamed that he had not finished the work properly, resentful that Min had not given him complete instructions. Fill the cart, that had been the order, and he had done it. Was he expected to read Min's mind as well? But the shame won out in Tree-Ear. He feared being sent away before he could learn to make a pot.
"I am sorry that I displeased the Honourable Potter," Tree-Ear said. "If he would be so good as to give me another chance, he will not be disappointed."
"Hmm." Min turned and walked toward the side of the house. Tree-Ear stood still for a moment, unsure of what to do. "Well?" Min turned back impatiently. "Are you coming, beggar boy? Or are you a statue with your feet frozen to the ground?" Tree-Ear's joy at being forgiven was like a wisp of smoke. Min's orders for the day blew it into nothingness. His task was the same as the previous days, to fill the cart with wood, and this time unload it at the kiln site. Each day, Tree-Ear appeared at Min's door eagerly. Each day, Min sent him up the mountain with the cart to chop more wood. At night, with Crane Man's careful ministrations, the wound on Tree-Ear's hand would begin to heal, the tender pink layer toughening slightly. But at the start of the next day's work, it would split and bleed again. Tree-Ear came to expect the pain. The throbbing was like an unwelcome companion who appeared daily after the first few strokes of the axe. On the third day, Crane Man had offered to come with him. Tree-Ear's mind raced to think of a polite refusal. He knew what would happen. Crane Man would want to spare Tree-Ear's blistered hand and would take up the axe himself. Tree-Ear shuddered, picturing Crane Man trying to chop wood while leaning on his crutch. He might well injure his good leg.
"Your offer of help is kindness itself," Tree-Ear answered. "But if it is all the same to you, it is far better for me to return to a meal already prepared. I could not imagine greater assistance than this."
Crane Man was satisfied. It seemed to Tree-Ear that his friend spent the entire day figuring out how to transform a handful of weeds and bones into something that resembled a meal. Over the days, Tree-Ear developed a routine of work and rest, a period of diligent chopping and loading, then a break. This was better than several hours of frenzied chopping that left him with a vast, untidy pile of wood, which took much time to load and left him exhausted. In the brief periods of rest, he was sometimes able to gather a little food, a few wild mushrooms here, a handful of fern sprouts there. Crane Man had taught him well on their many walks through these mountains together. Tree-Ear knew which mushrooms were tasty and which deadly. He knew the birds by their songs and how a mountain lion's spoor looked different from that of a deer. And he never lost his way, for he knew where the streams ran, pointing sure as an arrow back down the mountain toward the road. Besides his quiet times reading the mountain, Tree-Ear's favourite part of the day was unloading the wood at the kiln site. The kiln was located at the far end of the village from Min's house. Nearby was a large, roughly built shed. Tree-Ear wheeled the cart to the shed's entry, then carried armfuls of wood inside where it would stay dry. The wood was stacked as high as a man could reach, in orderly piles on either side of a central aisle. Tree-Ear liked arranging his wood neatly so the potters could take what they needed without the whole of the stack collapsing. At the kiln site, he often saw potters whose turn it was to use the kiln. They would greet him with a nod when he arrived. On the fourth day, one of them spoke to him. "You are Min's new boy, are you not?" Tree-Ear knew the potter who spoke. His name was Keng. He was old enough for grey to streak his hair, but younger than Min, with a keen eye and a restless manner. Tree-Ear lowered the handles of the cart to the ground and bowed his head. "High time the old man got himself some help," Keng spoke with what seemed like an edge to his voice. "The last few times he did not bring anywhere near his proper share of wood."
Then King stepped forward and began to help unload the cart, so Trier's work was finished earlier than usual. He was left with enough time to rifle through a rubbish dump on his way home. The cabbage core that he found would add to Craneman's culinary efforts for dinner. It was the morning of the 10th day. The evening before, Trier had returned the cart to its usual spot next to Min's house and had lingered about for a few moments. But Min did not emerge from the house, so Trier had departed at last, his debt of work paid in full. Awake for most of the night, Trier had considered over and over how best to approach Min. In the 9 days of work, Trier had not once touched clay. He would never be able to make a pot unless he could continue his relationship with the potter. Trier rehearsed his words one last time as he neared Min's house. He drew in a breath and held it for a moment to steady himself, then called out, "Master Potter!" To Trier's surprise, Min's wife opened the door. He knew, of course, that Min was married. On the days that he had spied on Min, Trier had occasionally glimpsed the wife coming out to the yard to scatter grain for the chickens or to fetch water. But because she had nothing to do with the pottery work, Trier had ignored her. And in the past several days of woodcutting, he had not seen or thought of her at all. Now he bowed his head as he stood before her. "Is the master home?" he asked. "He is at his breakfast," she answered. "You may wait at the back of the house." Trier nodded his thanks and stepped away, but the woman spoke again, quietly. "A good thing you're chopping the wood. He is not as young as he once was." Her voice trailed off. Trier glanced up at her and their eyes met. Hers were bright and soft, set in a small face netted with fine wrinkles. He dropped his gaze at once, not wishing to be considered impolite. Like Craneman's eyes, he thought, and wondered why. Min was washing his hands in a basin under the eaves when Trier reached the backyard.
"What are you doing here?"
Min's voice was cross, and he did not look up.
"It has been 9 days, and your debt is discharged. If you came to hear me say it, you can go now."
Trier bowed. "I beg the Honourable Potter to pardon my insolence," he said. "I wish to express my gratitude."
"Yes, yes," Min said impatiently. "What is it?"
"It would be a great honour for me to continue working for the potter." Trier began the speech he had planned so carefully. "If he would consider—"
"I cannot pay you."
Min's interruption could hardly have been more abrupt, but the curt words swept over Trier like cool rain over a parched field. "I cannot pay you" was the same as yes. A surge of joy lifted Trier's heart into his throat, so that he had to cough politely before speaking again. "To work for such a master is payment enough," he murmured.
"Temple bell until sundown, every day," said Min.
Trier found himself on the ground, collapsed in a full bow of gratitude. It was all he could do to keep himself from running all the way back to the bridge to tell Craneman the good news.
"Clay today, not wood."
Those were Min's orders for the 10th day. Once again, Trier trundled the cart, this time along the river road, until he reached the digging area. Here the clay had been cut away in neat slabs, leaving a pattern of staggered rectangles in the river bank. Trier paused for a moment when he reached the clay pits. He had passed by the pits many times before, and had always liked looking at the scene there. The geometric pattern of the clay bank pleased him, but today he felt as though he was seeing the men and boys working there for the first time. Using spades, they slashed at the clay with movements almost too swift to follow. When a slab of clay had been outlined with the spade, it was cut away from the bank and heaved into a nearby cart or basket. Trier watched for a while, the spade Min had given him on his shoulder. Then he slid down the muddy bank to stand in the shallow water. Raising the spade high over his shoulder, he brought it down with a dull thunk. It sliced into the wet clay, and Trier noted with satisfaction the clean line made by the spade's edge. He tugged at the spade's handle, ready to make his next cut. The spade did not budge. Trier frowned and pulled again. The head of the spade was well and truly buried. Trier tried using both hands down low on the handle. The clay made squelching, sucking noises as if it were trying to swallow the spade. Finally, Trier was forced to claw away the clay around the spade head in order to free it. His arms and legs were already covered with mud. He paused to brush away a mosquito and rubbed a swash of mud across one side of his face. At last, he stood up and swung the spade again. It took him all morning to fill the cart with clay. The other diggers were long gone, having cut their clay with a swift skill that left Trier alone and in despair. Heavy! The wet clay was far heavier than he had ever imagined. He could not begin to lift a slab with a spade. He had to cut each slab into several pieces and lift them one at a time into the cart. Treear scowled to see the misshapen masses of clay in his cart, so different from the neat rectangles of the other workers. Moreover, the spade work had torn open his blistered hand again. But it was not so painful as it had been on the mountainside, for here he could apply handfuls of cooling, soothing mud to the wound. By the time the cart was loaded, Treear wore mud like a second skin. Even raising his eyebrows was difficult, for his forehead was stiff with dried clay. And he was so exhausted that he could hardly bear the thought of wheeling the now heavy cart back to Min's house. Then a sudden thought came to him. Dinner! He had forgotten in the toil of the morning. Apprentices, assistants, the lowliest workers in every trade, no matter what their status, it was the master's duty to provide a meal for them in the middle of the workday. Now that Treear was no longer working off a debt, Min was obliged to feed him. The thought broke through Treear's fatigue like a shaft of sunlight piercing a cloud. He left the cart on the road and bounded into the river. He scrubbed and splashed and ducked under the water completely to get rid of as much grime as he possibly could. It would never do to appear for his first working meal dressed in mud. Min glanced briefly at the clay-filled cart.
"You were long enough in returning," he said with a sniff. "I will not be able to do any more work until after my midday meal."
He walked into the house, having said nothing about Treear's food. But Treear barely had time to wonder before Min's wife appeared in the doorway. She held out a parcel tied up in cloth. Treear trotted to the door, resisting the impulse to snatch the parcel from her. He bowed his head and held out his hands, palms up and together, as was proper when accepting something. Min's wife placed the cloth package in his hands. "Eat well. Work well," she said. A hot lump rose in Treear's throat. He raised his head and saw in her eyes that she heard his thanks, even though he could not speak the words. Treear sat on a stone under the polonia tree and untied the corners of the cloth. It held a gourd bowl filled with rice, whose whiteness was accented by a few dark shreds of savoury dried fish, and a little pile of kimchi, pickled cabbage, vivid with seasonings of red pepper, green onions, and garlic. A pair of chopsticks was laid neatly across the top of the bowl. Treear picked up the chopsticks and stared for a moment. Of one thing he was certain. The feast-day banquets in the palace of the king could never better the modest meal before him, for he had earned it. Treear carted another load of clay for Min that afternoon, then returned to the bridge where Crane Man had stewed some wild mushrooms for their supper. Treear spoke eagerly about his work that day. It was not until Crane Man rose to gather the supper bowls that Treear noticed something was missing. The crutch. Sure enough, after handing Treear the bowls to wash, Crane Man sat down with his knife and a sturdy, straight branch and began to whittle a new crutch. Treear wiped out the bowls, stacked them neatly on their rock shelf, and finally asked, "What happened to the old one?" Crane Man paused in his work, then waved his knife impatiently. "Stupidity happened," he answered. "There was a run of flounder today." That was all he said, but Treear heard much more. Although Chulpo was on the sea, it was a potter's village, not a fishing village. The men and boys seldom took time from their work to fish. Still, they all knew the useful skill of fishing, and the women and girls often gathered shellfish at low tide. A run of flounder meant that a school of the tasty fish had come into shore far closer than usual. The waves even tossed fish right up on the beach. Such news sent many scrambling for their bamboo poles, but one had to be among the first to run from the village down to the shore. The flounder found their way back out to sea soon enough, and the fish flopping about on the sand were scooped up only by the quickest. It had always been Treear who skipped out to the beach at the first word of a flounder run, and he had never returned without a fat fish or two for a rare feast. Now he knew without asking that Crane Man had hobbled down to the beach and lurched about on the sand, so treacherous to his crutch, only to come away empty-handed. Crane Man shaved another curl of wood, then held the crutch up to his eye, squinting to check that its lines were true.
"I was angry about not getting any fish," he said as he returned to his whittling. "So I struck my crutch against a rock. It broke, of course."
A little pile of shavings had grown at Crane Man's feet. Treear crouched and stirred the pile with his finger, too ashamed to look up.
In his mind he saw Crane Man making his slow, painful way back from the beach with only a broken crutch to help him, and no fish for his trouble. How was it that in enjoying his noontime meal, Tree-Ear had forgotten his friend? He should have saved some of the food for Crane Man. If it had been the other way around, Crane Man would never have forgotten. Tree-Ear swept the shavings into his palm, then threw them into the river. As he watched the current carry them away, he mumbled, "I am sorry about the flounder."
"Ah, friend," Crane Man said, "you must mean, I am sorry about your leg, because that is the reason for our fishless supper today. But I think it a waste for either of us to spend too much time in sorrow over something we cannot change."
Crane Man grunted as he stood, then leaned on the new crutch to test it. Satisfied, he nodded at Tree-Ear.
"Besides, when I leave this world, I will have two good legs and no need for such as this."
And he tapped the crutch with his free hand. Still cross with himself, Tree-Ear grumbled half under his breath, "Some of us will have four good legs." Crane Man batted at him with the new crutch.
"What are you saying, impudent boy? That I will be a beast in the next life?"
Tree-Ear began to protest.
"No, not you." Then he stopped and grinned. "Well, maybe," he said, putting his hand on his chin in an attitude of deep thought. "A rabbit, I think. Very clever and quick."
"You had better be quick now yourself," Crane Man bellowed in mock anger, brandishing the crutch sword fashion. Tree-Ear began hopping about the little den like a rabbit, dodging Crane Man's jabs and swipes, his shame forgotten for the moment as the day ended in laughter. Chapter 4. In the morning, Tree-Ear presented himself at Min's door before the temple bell rang. As he had hoped, it was Min's wife who answered his call. He held out a gourd bowl and bowed his head.
"I have brought my own bowl today, so as not to inconvenience the Honourable Potter's wife," he said.
Tree-Ear's plan was to eat only half his food, leave the bowl hidden somewhere, and take the other half home to Crane Man at the end of the day. Min's wife nodded and took the bowl from him, but he could see the puzzled look in her eyes. The day before, he had returned the bowl and chopsticks to her after washing and wiping them. Clearly, there had been no need for him to bring his own bowl. Tree-Ear turned away, feeling guilt like a shadow across his brow, and hoped fervently that he had not offended her. "I'm not really deceiving anyone," he argued to himself. "And I haven't asked for more food. It should make no difference to her which bowl." He carted clay again for Min, and by mid-afternoon he had grown more accustomed to the work. He was learning the tricky balance of spade work, deep enough to make a clean cut, but not so deep as to bury the spade head in the mire. The work went more quickly now, and the muscles in his back and arms that had been strengthened by the woodcutting did not cry out so loudly any more. Tree-Ear brought the final load of clay back to Min's. As usual, the potter was nowhere in sight at the end of the day, so Tree-Ear left the cart parked under the eaves and went to retrieve the remaining half of his midday meal. Tree-Ear caught his breath. The gourd bowl was not beneath the polonia tree where he had left it. He searched the area around the tree.